Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 789. It is January the 19th, 1987. This is the anniversary of the birthday of Martin Luther King, so I'm going to talk about Mr. King this evening, and it is pertinent to Irangate and Contragate because on the second half of this one-hour program, I'll talk about the relationship of National Security Council to Reverend Martin Luther King. In our own local community today, there was a three-hour ceremony remembering Martin Luther King, a seven-block march, and throughout the United States, people remembered him in different ways. I personally think the whole celebration idea is a very hypocritical kind of activity because the people who are doing these things are not investigating who murdered John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, black leaders, white leaders, Robert Kennedy, who helped the blacks and the farm workers and so forth. This is a time of letting your conscience out and having a few prayers and niceties and quoting I Have a Dream 3,000 times every single second for one day. The New York Times had an article written by Edward Olshaker, January the 15th, titled King's Dream is Kept at a Distance. And the subtitle is Tributes Will Mask the Growing Number of Poor People. Now, Edward Olshaker is editor of an Army newspaper, U.S. Army, at Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama, a home base of many Nazis that were brought here from Peenemünde, worked with Adolf Hitler, and I was wondering what in the world he had to say about this occasion that would be appropriate. And strangely enough, what he said about it is very much similar to my feelings about this holiday and the way it is remembered. And he says that people will have high-toned official pronouncements on Martin Luther King, that this is their shtick, that we're really great at symbolism in the United States. The one thing we do is symbolism, and we hide the real intentions of the originator of the ideas, and we mask the failures of social programs. Since Martin Luther King was killed, the people will use well-chosen words, and they refrain from dealing responsively and immediately with the still urgent issues that Dr. Martin Luther King had, and that it is a way that we're comfortable praising him because we hold him perpetually distant from us, and he's in a safe place because he's in his grave. And this article goes on to say that the one thing Martin Luther King didn't like, in quotes, were mouth-pious irrelevancies and sanctimonious trivialities, which he accused people of when he was serving time in the Birmingham jail. And this opinion of Mr. Edward Olshaker is that many people will feel very comfortable with this kind of a day, just having speeches and so forth, but not really getting down to continuing the things that Martin Luther King wanted or tangling with the very hard problems, that this is sort of an easing of conscience for his having died, and people sit back and annually can go through this process, which is just pure symbolism, and that Martin Luther King wouldn't have wanted this anniversary celebration this way, but it serves the purposes of the particular black leaders now. Then he said, Dr. King is manageable today. His discomforting challenge to the nation to live up to its Judeo-Christian ideals and democratic principles is long gone, his discomforting challenge. Now we have him where we want him, on a pedestal, carved in stone, ideal and conveniently unthreatening. When he was alive, he wasn't so popular. The FBI didn't like him. People didn't like his anti-Vietnam stance. But now his birthday comes around, and we obscure and forget the real nature of his work and so forth, and I feel exactly like that. He concludes by saying his fiery oratory emphasized urgency and immediacy, but this National Day of Symbolism, paid for with reverence that Dr. King would have preferred to use to feed the hungry, represents the opposite of a sense of urgency. It carries an underlying self-congratulatory message that on his birthday, on our calendar, we have finally assimilated him into our culture, which means we have let this black man be honored here, which has nothing to do with the way Martin Luther King wanted the world to be seen. Now, last year, on the anniversary of his birthday, Mrs. Martin Luther King had a celebration for him, and the guest of honor was none other than Ryosha Sasakawa. He got the humanitarian award from Mrs. Martin Luther King. Sasakawa was on television earlier this year at the Jimmy Carter Library. He gave $17 million to the library Again, they had a shot of Coretta King. I think he gave $1 or $2 million to the Martin Luther King Center. And then on DVD, they had went to a third location, the grave of Richard Nixon's mother and father in Whittier. And Ryosha Sasakawa was there giving more money, $7 million, to Richard Nixon over the table. He gave a lot more earlier, and he helped found the Reverend Moon Church and assisted with the founding of the World Anti-Communist League. Now, when Mrs. Martin Luther King, Coretta King, was down in South Africa, she had an appointment to meet Mr. Botha, and it was Mrs. Mandela and other civil rights people that said they wouldn't see, not civil rights, black activists, that said they wouldn't see her if she saw Prime Minister Botha in South Africa. And while she was down there even entertaining the idea of seeing and meeting with that man, there was supposed to be a group of nations, the Commonwealth nations in Great Britain, having their annual get-together and athletic games, and the Commonwealth was going to be called off. 24 countries boycotted it from Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, including India. And they wanted to call it off because Margaret Thatcher didn't want sanctions against South Africa. And she issued British passports to two athletes at the time of the Olympic Games so they would qualify as British and not South African. Well, the man who rescued the Commonwealth Games, because the Commonwealth was so fascist and approved of the South African policies, the man who rescued the game was Ryosha Sasakawa. So while Mrs. King is down there in South Africa ready to see Prime Minister Botha, the mentor of her center that gave her millions last year is up in London. The London Times had an article August 10th this past year about Sasakawa titled Games Rescuer is Linked to Moonies, and it tells about how he helped found the World Anti-Communist League by way of Reverend Moon, how he has links to powerful right-wing figures in Japan. Sasakawa, according to the London Times, and there are many books about him, started making post-war billions, organizing gambling, speedboat races. He was known for his pre-war fascism. He headed his own 15,000-strong black shirt army, spent 3 years in jail as a war criminal, and he's still known for his links to brain control, mind control, Reverend Moon's churches, and the kind of things that they do, in addition to manufacturing gunpowder and networks of violence linked to the Sikhs and terrorism and murders and planes that blow up and extortion and bombs and so forth. Sasakawa hands out the money, and the whole hypocrisy of having a dinner and having him as a guest of honor has nothing to do with Martin Luther King. And it is disgusting that she even entertains this person, much less honors him. King wouldn't like that either. A new book came out just this year called Yakuza, about the Japanese mafia. It's written by David Kaplan and Alex Dubrow and Addison Wesley. And in there, there's a description of Sasakawa as a power broker who dominates the shady areas of Japan, which is prostitution, extortion, murders. And again, it quotes in this book his title of himself, the world's wealthiest fascist, and he's part of a group of right-wing Japanese godfathers who've worked in the crime world for a long time. And according to an article in the Los Angeles Herald in Japan, they organize ways that where the members enrich themselves with pornography, extortion, drug smuggling, and murder. The Yakuza are well known for their tattoos. The ties between the Yakuza and the Central Intelligence are notorious, with the Korean CIA. And can you imagine Mrs. Martin Luther King having a ceremony and having him the guest of honor? I saw that on television, and luckily I believe I was able to tape that particular day. So while the Commonwealth Games continued in England, while Sasakawa put up these millions of dollars, she was down in South Africa, and it was Winnie Mandela and Reverend Alan Bosack who said they wouldn't see her if she went to visit with Botha, and she called off the trip with Botha, but her intention in the first place was to go see him. Now, for the remaining of this half hour, I just want to run through some of the ways that the FBI and the federal government and the Justice Department worked on Martin Luther King. The information I have is taken from two committee investigations. One, the U.S. Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities. This was done in 1976, headed by the Church Committee. The second was the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee on Assassinations, which held hearings on the King assassination in 1978. Now, both of these committees came to a conclusion that there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. The House Select Committee spent $6 million to find out if there was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. In both cases, it was yes. I have in my library the hearings from both of those hearings, all of the hearings. There hasn't been one black person or white person on the Monterey Peninsula who has examined those books or read them or had their fingers on them. There was this Peace March for King, involved 1,000 people last year. Maybe we'll see it was 2,000 or 3,000 this year. But there isn't one head walking down those streets or under, you know, over those two pair of feet that march that want to know who killed Martin Luther King. This is a wonderful way to say a black man made it. How did he make it? By having his head blown off. Again, the hypocrisy here is so horrendous. In the 1950s and 60s, the FBI had the COINTEL program. It stopped in the early 70s when it was exposed with its role of J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Nixon and the Defense Department monkeying around in the CIA in domestic activities here in the United States. Martin Luther King started becoming noticed by the FBI after March 1963 when he gave the speech in Washington, I Have a Dream, and also when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. Then the FBI began to escalate their surveillance. They started the black bag job of entering his offices. There were first 12 burglaries and opening of office of his office in Atlanta and in Memphis, but after the time period where he became more prominent with the Nobel, then they went into his offices more and opened them up to see what he was saying and what he was doing, under the guise of looking for communists. But the big fear of J. Edgar Hoover was the charisma of Martin Luther King, that they didn't want, in quotes, another messiah. He was very active in 1956 with the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. That's the one to have integration of city buses. At the end of that year, he was active with the Freedom Rides, which was to desegregate bus transportation facilities across the South. That was to cross through the different states. One was in a city, the other was to cross city into various states. That's when CORE was formed, the Congress of Racial Equality, in 1956, and he was active in that. J. Edgar Hoover asked the officials in Mobile, Alabama, to keep checking on Martin Luther King, and they kept saying that we don't have anything back to report. And in 1957, a year later, he formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. So in 1956 was the Montgomery, Alabama boycott. Late 56 was CORE and desegregate through the interstate and the Freedom Rides. And then the next was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And the FBI wanted to know, are there communists involved in that? They saw an article about the CORE activities in the SCLC. So there's an article in the Pittsburgh Courier. So the FBI began collecting papers on him and asking the Atlanta office, Atlanta, Georgia. They found no communists. King was on Meet the Press on April 1960, and if you make national television, you're not Henry Kissinger, then you must be a national threat. So the FBI took note that he even went to India in 1960, and he made Meet the Press, and that gave them an excuse again to start their clippings and files. And he met a communist named Ben Davis in New York City, so the FBI was concerned about that. Then Martin Luther King published an article in Nation magazine. He was a terrible threat to the United States. He'd been on Meet the Press, gone to India, and was in Nation magazine in February 61. So the FBI began to escalate their activities on King. And pretty soon, by April of 62, J. Edgar Hoover asked King's name to be on Section A of the Reserve Index. The House Select Committee said that the index was, in quotes, a list of persons whom the FBI felt in the time of national emergency are in a position to influence others against the national interest, or likely to furnish material financial aid to subversive elements due to their subversive associations and ideology. So when he made that list, he was then under the files of William Sullivan, who, if you've read the Torbett document, was part of the Permandex Operation Division 5 of the FBI, that had already decided by 1960 that in case John Kennedy lost the election to Richard Nixon, that John Kennedy could have his head blown off. And the FBI was working with Robert Mayhew, an FBI agent, and John Rosselli, and Sam Giancana, persons who were to be killed at the same period that William Sullivan was to be killed, when the House Select Committee was investigating the John Kennedy and the Martin Luther King murders, and they were tied to these same people. By February 62, J. James Bland, the chief of subversive control sections, sent a memo to William Sullivan, who was in charge of domestic intelligence division. Should we warn Dr. King that we suspect that some person that he knows might be a communist? And J. Gruber said, no, don't tell him, because King is no good anyway. And there was the suggestion or fear, even noted in the House Select Committee, that maybe this excuse of not telling Martin Luther King was because they were sending plants or agent provocateurs whereby they would have a reason to continue investigating Martin Luther King. And by July 63, the summer before the murder of John Kennedy, there was a general investigation titled CIRM, Communist Influence in Racial Matters. And just before the Washington rally in 1963 in August, the FBI Domestic Intelligence Division set up an office to investigate the Communist Party. Will they influence the American Negro? And William Sullivan testified before the Select Committee, he was in charge of the DOD at the time, that he went against J. Edgar Hoover's response that there were no communists involved with Martin Luther King, and he said that to the House Select Committee. By then, in 1977, he had been forced out of the FBI, but right after he testified, and later when he was supposed to testify again, William Sullivan was killed. He was taken for a moose out in a field and had his head blown away. Then orders came from J. Edgar Hoover, in quotes, to get King, no matter what Sullivan or field agents say, no matter what their opinion is. So the DID, the Domestic Intelligence Division, they wanted J. Edgar Hoover's favor, so they started changing their position. And then William Sullivan wrote, after I Have a Dream speech in 1963, we were wrong, he's dangerous, we must mark him now. These were his words. If we have not done so before, he is the most dangerous Negro in the future of this nation from the standpoint of communism, the Negro, and national security. Not black, but the Negro. So they already had a decision that, yes, he is dangerous. He could mass 250,000 people in Washington, D.C., and he's a threat to this country. Interestingly enough, a gentleman who lives on the Monterey Peninsula, who's head of the American Civil Liberties Union group here since 1981, since Reagan's been president, went to hear that speech in Washington. He was quoted in the newspaper today. But for all purposes, he has no use for people like me who want to feel out the powers that be and look into the murder of Martin Luther King. He treats me like a piece of dirt because my investigations challenge these people who don't want to go beyond being recognized as people who care, who are out there marching. He went to Washington at that time, but once King is visible to all these people and has his head blown off, they run back like a bunch of turtles or ostriches and just come out to have their celebrations and remembrances that they touched someone famous, but the fact that he was slain is of no matter to very many people. Well, anyway, in July, just moving up towards the Kennedy assassination, Attorney General Robert Kennedy sent the Commerce Committee and the Justice Department memos based on all evidence we know from the FBI and others. There's no evidence that the top or any major civil rights groups are communist, and this is true as to Martin Luther King. But in the fall of 63, as we got closer to the Kennedy assassination, J. Edgar Hoover said if the Kennedys wouldn't go along with this, that King was infiltrated by communists or was a communist, they threatened to embarrass the administration by leaks that would appear in newspapers exposing alleged members of the Communist Party working with that Southern Christian Leadership Conference group. So if the Kennedys say there are no communists, they would put articles in the paper that he was linked to communists and embarrass them. And the threat of blackmail, according to the accounts I've read, worked, and Robert Kennedy issued wiretap orders, in quotes, to protect ourselves because they were being threatened with leaks. So even though he knew there were no communists involved, J. Edgar Hoover got the Kennedys to go ahead with the wiretaps, and then later they could say, see, the Kennedys were wiretapping Martin Luther King. I'm wondering now, by wiretapping him up through 1968 when he was killed, if they weren't setting the taps so that after Kennedy was killed in November 63, they would hear conversations of persons involved and wanting to know who killed John Kennedy, and could pick them up if Martin Luther King talked about them at his home, his hotel, motel, or whatever. Division 5 was active in Atlanta, New York, and the Domestic Intelligence Division started major planning on Martin Luther King. They started December 23rd, 1963, 1 month after John Kennedy was killed, Division 5 agents met, and they had a program called How Can They Neutralize King as a Negro Leader and Develop Evidence That He Depended Upon Communists. And they suggested several courses of action. One, to investigate all employees for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The other was to go into their financial situation. And the third, which they did, was keep close watch on his personal activities. So they began wiretaps in hotels and motels where he slept and who he slept with. And the purpose of this meeting was to pick up what he was doing. And they did. And then later they played some of these for Mrs. Martin Luther King. And they even suggested on tape cassettes they told sent to King that it is time for him to kill himself and get himself out of the way, that he was a fraud, and that they have tapes of his sexual encounters, and that when people knew it, they would lose all interest in him. In 1964, the FBI sent to King's wife in the mail a composite tape purporting to be a recording of sexual behavior of King and his associates. With the tape came an anonymous note to King calling him a dissolute, abnormal, moral imbecile, suggesting he kill himself by Christmas. King, there is only one thing left to do. You have 34 days left in which to do it. There is but one way out for you. You better take it before your filthy, immoral, fraudulent self is barred to the nation. This is J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. And William Sullivan testified that he directed the war against Martin Luther King, knowing that King was not a communist. The purpose of putting the taps was to find commies, and that they were most interested, this is a quotation from the House Select Committee, in exposing him in some manner or another to discredit him. That was the December 23rd meeting that was just shortly before the Warren Commission was to get together, when J. Edgar Hoover was saying Oswald was the lone assassin, and they were wiretapping King to get whatever sounds they could get out of, as I say, the motel, the hotel, and get sound tape recordings of his private activities. On October 15th, 1963, Mr. Sullivan said that there was still no evidence through this whole time period of the communists, but the main meeting they had was to find sexual things that would embarrass him that had nothing to do with politics. Alan Belmont of the FBI passed over a report. It was called a monograph titled Communism and the Negro Movement. He gave it to J. Edgar Hoover, and it was an analysis of communism and Negroes in America, and there was a memo, this report is explosive. It can be regarded as a personal attack on Martin Luther King. It will have a heavy impact on the Attorney General and everyone else to whom we disseminate. And this was a report. The FBI memo said the memorandum makes good reading. It's based on information from reliable sources. It will startle the Attorney General, that's Robert Kennedy, in view of his past association with King and the fact that we are disseminating this outside the agency and letting other people know about it. He may resent this, but nevertheless, the memorandum is a powerful warning against communists and communist influence in the Negro movement, and we would carry out our responsibility by disseminating this. And copies were sent to the Secretary of State, the CIA, the White House, and this memorandum had to do a lot with the privacy and the particular things that King did, and a lot of it was taken from stolen material out of his offices. Congress was warned off the record about King that they shouldn't associate with King, that they should acknowledge his receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize. These are taken from FBI reports. That they should undermine his reception by foreign heads of state and American ambassadors in countries where he visits. When King returned to the United States, steps were taken to reduce the support for a huge banquet and a special day that was being planned in his honor, which has finally come about. And then the FBI program went on to destroy King. They wanted to discredit him with churches and universities and press, and they sent this memorandum about his activities and the possible communists and the highest influence they had. And they sent it to the National Council of Churches, the Baptist World Alliance, leading Protestant ministers. They should stop support of SCLC. And they persuaded them that, in quotes, Negro leaders should completely isolate King and remove him from the role he is now occupying in civil rights activities. The FBI sought to influence the universities to withhold any honorary degrees that they may think of giving Martin Luther King, to prevent publications of articles favorable to King, and this is important for material, as I'll have on the second side of this half of this broadcast, and find friendly news sources that would print unfavorable articles. The FBI offered to pay for reporters for tape recordings they made and play for them their own tape recordings made for microphones from the surveillance of hotel rooms that Martin Luther King stayed in. If you publish these articles about him, we will discredit you by showing who he had sexual alliances with or liaisons with and so forth. And they gathered these tapes to discredit him and ruin his position or try to ruin as a civil rights leader. The FBI made preparations to promote someone to assume the role of leadership of the Negro people when King was completely discredited. Of course, I believe, and it's not hard to figure that out, it was Jesse Jackson who took the mantle as soon as Martin Luther King was killed, and he would assume this role. The campaign of King included attempts to destroy the SCLC by cutting the source of the funds. They considered on some occasions plans to cut the support of the major contributions going into his organization. One FBI field office recommended the FBI send letters to the SCLC donors. They had the names of the people over King's forged signature, warning them that they were under investigation by the IRS. The IRS files on King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were carefully scrutinized for financial irregularities for over a year, and the FBI unsuccessfully attempted to establish that King had a secret foreign bank account in which he was sequestering funds. The FBI subsequently considered the possibility of getting Detroit policemen to raid King's hotel in March of 64, keep track of the Miami police force would raid his hotel room in 1966, according to unsigned FBI documents. In April 64, FBI headquarters were instructing agents to continue to gather information concerning his physical activities so that we may consider using this information at an opportune time in a counterintelligence move to discredit him and to consider the possibility of utilizing our contacts in the news media field to talk about King. Eventually, by 1964, and of course the harassment went on until he was murdered in 1968, but this is under the Kennedy administration when J. Edgar Hoover was carrying on these activities with the FBI, and I'm sure that John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy weren't privy to all of these things that were going on. In late 64, the FBI sent to King's wife in the mail, and I mentioned that to you before, tapes of his sexual behavior, and as I said, telling him that he's a moral imbecile, it's time to kill himself. The King's contents were described by King's aide, Andrew Young, as a bunch of guys sitting around who were friendly, who were bidding each other some friendship, intimately talking. Toward the end of the recording, there is a moaning and groaning as if sexual intercourse. Andrew Young tries to cover it up, but whether or not it was sexual intercourse at Martin Luther King doesn't really matter. Well, I guess it matters quite a great deal, and particularly since he's a reverend and since he was married and had a family. And if he chose to carry on that way, such as John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, it only served the purposes of the CIA and the FBI and the Defense Department, because they could use this to blackmail those people who had political good intentions but did indeed wander away from areas that could discredit them. And it's a tragedy that Martin Luther King allowed himself to be in a position and didn't abstain from these activities, considering the position he was taking of prominence and the goal he had for the black people. He should have kept certain standards for himself so that they couldn't tie up all of his work. These activities of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, the three most prominent cuckolders of political, well, I guess I'll take that back, Eisenhower with his mistress, and a lot of politicians have had sexual exploits. Franklin Roosevelt allegedly had a mistress, and she lived around the White House and traveled with them. I'm not going to put moral value or judgment on it, but it isn't the established way to behave as a public leader. And it is a thing that is used by the powers that be to discredit these people, and it does a lot of harm to the activities and causes. If you're going to be political activists, you have to be as good as the average person is or thinks you are. And if you're not, it catches up with you, and all of your work goes to naught, or a great deal of it, because of this particular evidence. Well, this activity of wiretapping him, following him, sending tapes of his sexual meetings in hotels and motels was more important to the Bureau than his political alleged communist connections that they couldn't find. But in any event, Martin Luther King was smeared and, as I say, told to kill himself, and the FBI continued these activities until 1968 when he didn't oblige them by killing himself, and then he had to be killed. Well, that's the way the government treated Martin Luther King, and now for the second half of World Watchers, I'm going to talk about the National Security Council and their position towards Martin Luther King and all civil rights activists right here in the United States, because so far as I know, their opinion on what they're going to do with blacks and other people has never been discussed openly or challenged. So for all we know, their plans still hold. This is Mae Bressel, and after 1 minute, we'll continue with what is called the King-Alfred Plan.